About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No, no." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, "No, no." He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I have a returning guest today, somebody that I'm always excited to talk to. She had a very interesting discussion with the Yemeni ambassador, and some very revealing information was discussed, as well as another story we're going to talk about is on top of all of that, and probably plenty of other things that her and I will get into talking about because we just tend to have interesting conversations. Thank you so much for joining me today, Vanessa. How are you?
Hi, Ryan. Good to be back on.
For those that aren't familiar, Vanessa Beely is somebody you should absolutely be checking out. One of the, as I like to say, one of the last surviving investigative journalists. So you had a very revealing discussion with the Yemeni ambassador, which I'd like to point out right out of the gate. It's just something, you know, it seems oddly absent from all the rest of these Western countries. You know, they're meeting with Yemeni ambassadors. Like, where's that at? The world's worst humanitarian crisis, and the only person willing to talk to them is the actual investigative journalists out there, not the mainstream. So, what I want to do today, so I want to talk about what you just heard from them and discussion there, and then maybe we can get into more of the background behind Yemen, what's going on today. But so what first got you, what was the motivation for you to set this meeting up or to go and do this? Was it something they reached out to you to make happen? So how did that all fall into place?
No, I had actually previously last year interviewed the previous Yemeni ambassador to Damascus, which again was a really interesting discussion. But since the genocidal war of aggression started against Yemen in March, in fact, we're coming up to 6 years on the 25th of March this year, which is just extraordinary. I mean, I remember when it started and when the UN peace envoy at the time, Jamal Ben Omar, was saying there is no need for this aggression. The Yemenis themselves were arriving at political resolution when the Saudi coalition began their bombing campaign. And so at that point, I don't think anybody expected us to be here 6 years later, and the war is still going on, and the UN facilitated siege and blockade of all the Yemenis. You know, that we'll go into the history of UN Resolution 2216 and why it is criminally responsible. Yet again, the UN enabling and facilitating the starvation, the deliberate starvation of 23 million or 27 million Yemenis.
Yeah, this is criminality under the rule of law. I mean, that's what this is. Now, let me ask you a question before we go further. What is the mark for you that you say in your mind where the war began, right? Or the illegal invasion, I would call it. Because, you know, as you well know, there's this, the economic warfare and the manipulation has been gone way back before that. So what in your mind is the marker for the beginning of what you call the war that we're talking about?
Well, it would be the 25th of March, 2015, when
the blockade was initiated.
No, that was when the Saudi aggression actually started. That was when the bombing campaign started. And that was, of course, enabled by Obama at that time. It was Obama that gave permission for that war to begin. Yemen at that point, as I say, Hadi, who is the recognized government, still the recognized government internationally, which in itself is a crime against Yemen, because Hadi had extended his Gulf Initiative mandate by 1 year because he hadn't achieved the goals and objectives that had been set for him. Among those included, of course, a new constitution. He had failed at the end of his mandate. It was extended illegally, according to Yemeni legal entities and lawyers. It was extended by 1 year. And at the end of that year, he had still not achieved the objectives that had been set for him. And he had effectively resigned. Again, this is all information that is not readily available. I've covered it in a number of articles, and I'll be doing sort of an update on the Yemeni conflict and where we are now with it for yourself, for Last American Vagabond, to commemorate the dreadful fact that this war has gone on for 6 years. And so Hadi effectively fled Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. He went to Aden, and from there, of course, he went to Riyadh, and it was in Riyadh that he called for the bombing of his own people. You know, and the unfortunate thing is that in the UN resolution 2216, this UN resolution, which is being used to criminally sanction 27 million Yemenis, is based on the legitimacy of Mansour Hadi, who is the Saudi puppet.
Right. On that point in general, so for more maybe background on that one part in general, why do you call him a puppet? I agree with you entirely, but so what in your mind makes him a puppet in regard to the political dynamic?
Because Hadi had been he'd been imposed by the Saudi regime. The Saudis, of course, have viewed Yemen for decades as a sort of colonial state. And the level of corruption within successive governments is what, of course, had led to some degree, the uprising in 2011. Hadi, if we look at what policies Hadi was pushing through prior to his resignation, he was looking at the balkanization of Yemen into six statelets. Now, those six statelets would have ensured that Ansarullah, the movement that was dedicated to the removal of the Saudi neocolonialist presence, their corruption, their influence on Yemeni governance, and to free Yemen from, you know, the yoke of colonialism. And by colonialism, of course, I also mean the influence of Britain, the influence of the US through their Saudi proxy to some extent. And not only Saudi, Qatari, UAE now, of course, is vying for influence inside Yemen. And we'll come on to that as well, because that subject came up in the discussion with the Yemeni ambassador, His Excellency Abdullah Sabri. Who has only just arrived in Damascus. I think it was about 2 or 3 months ago. So Hadi's plan, if you like, was to balkanize Yemen, to isolate Ansarullah. This is a very important point, to basically end up with Ansarullah in a segment of Yemen surrounded on all sides by sectarian states that were against Ansarullah, and without any access to sea ports, which is, you know, essential to their survival, to the survival of any element within Yemen. And so the fact also that Hardy, of course, fled almost immediately to Riyadh and then instructed the Sauds to bomb his own people for, you know, what he perceived as an insurrection. In reality, he had resigned. I believe actually he'd resigned twice.
Oddly interesting, the whole idea, just the idea of the insurrection. It's just funny to think about that in the context of what being named today. But one interestingly, in that point, I've constantly pointed out from the beginning of the, you know, the war map in Yemen, how oddly there is this massive Al Qaeda section right in the middle of their occupied territory that just never seems to be manipulated. It doesn't shrink. It's just constant. Right? You know, it's just funny. That will be more relevant as we discuss the Al Qaeda part. But before we move on to the discussion with the ambassador, in your opinion, to what degree do you see the Israeli government involved in Yemen, whether it's by proxy or just on the ground in general?
Well, actually, that was an interesting part of the discussion. And the previous discussions I'd had with Yemeni officials in Damascus also stated very clearly that Israel had been involved in the war from the beginning. The clarification of why Israel would be involved in it is, of course, their nemesis, Iran. Yemen, the last thing they want is for Yemen, and this is their perception, to become a satellite state of Iran. And what also came out of the more recent meeting, of course, is that the Yemenis themselves are developing missile technology, which Israel is claiming is threatening, for example, Tel Aviv. As far as they're concerned, Ansula are developing missile capability to target Tel Aviv. So, again, we have, you know, the familiar Israeli argument, preemptive aggression in self-defense. And so, whereas before Israel was probably a little bit clandestine in its support of the Saudi coalition, although it was a well-known fact that it was working together with the Saudis and, of course, with the British and the US in the control centers in Riyadh. I mean, it's well known that the US and the UK were actually designating targets in Yemen to be hit by the Saudi bombers.
Right.
You know, this was a well-known fact, and one assumes that Israel was also involved in that designation of targets. And, of course, we know the majority of the targets are civilian targets and civilian infrastructure targets. Therefore, they are committing a war crime every time they bomb Yemen, effectively. They're not hitting, most of the time, they're not hitting military targets. The US has had troops actually inside Yemen. That might have come as a bit of a shock to some people since, I think, around 2017, 2018. The US has also moved Patriot air defense onto the island of Socotra off the coast of Yemen, which is under the control of the Kuwaitis and the UAE. And actually, as part of the discussion with the Yemeni ambassador, he told me there are now Israeli troops on Socotra. So this is very much about, in the Israeli parlance, this is about limiting the Iranian potential to target Israel. And Israel is collaborating very closely with the United Arab Emirates. If you remember, we talked about the integration of Israel into CENTCOM. And within some of the think tanks in Israel, they're talking about an alliance with pragmatic Sunni Islamic states. And, of course, that includes United Arab Emirates, which is the conflict gold capital. Shami Nawani, another fantastic journalist, just described them on Twitter quite recently. They're the conflict gold capital for the US and the UK. They house many of the, what I call the British mercenary, former military, private security advisors, akin to Blackwater. James Lemessurier, the founder of the White Helmets, worked for Good Harbor International, which was set up by Richard C. Clarke in the UAE. You know, and the majority of those kind of private security firms are based in the UAE.
And we've actually, I think you and I have discussed the torture prisons and the CIA involvement as well as
absolutely, MLK. Yeah.
You know, it's so sickening to watch the overt war crimes, like the actions taken with the knowledge mm-hmm. that they're crimes, that they're illegal. And these are the people that are pointing to these elsewhere with no evidence, in fact, to say that they should be removed because of these things we can't prove, while we can prove they're mm-hmm. doing them all over the world. It's just clown world kind of scenario.
Well, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, and the Al Qaeda Arab Peninsula, which Al Qaeda in Yemen is known as, AQAP, of course, generated out of the war in Afghanistan, because AQAP, the extremist factions, which of course were power multiplied by the US in Afghanistan, then came back into Yemen from Afghanistan and were then allowed to flourish, of course, which then of course led to the Obama drone warfare.
Right.
Against Yemen, everybody, you know, should remember that.
Go ahead.
No, go on. AQAP basically was allowed, and again, this is another familiar story, right? You know, the so-called war on terror effectively allows terrorism to flourish. And that's exactly what we saw in Yemen. And in fact, prior to 2015, Ansarullah had almost entirely eradicated AQAP,
right.
And not only Ansarullah, but Ansarullah with the Yemeni army. So again, we see collaboration between the national forces and Ansarullah, or the Houthis, as you know, many in Western media like to describe them, to try and kind of belittle them down to this little group of insurrectionists, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, Ansarullah is a coalition resistance movement. It doesn't only represent the Houthis, it represents a huge number of parties that are against, as I said, any form of imperialism or neocolonialism. And so, AQAP had almost been eradicated leading up to the war in 2015. Then, of course, as the war developed, strangely, AQAP returned and flourished, particularly in the south, which is the primary target for the Saudi coalition.
Yeah, that's a very important point that I want my listeners to think about, because that's actually something that I'm reasonably new. I wasn't actually aware of I did know that there's a lot of that happening between the West names that they give groups and the name that they actually have. And I wasn't even aware that this was something that was almost Iraq. It's sort of like making it out to be like the Saudi idea. It's a family name and it's not really democratic, or like you say, to make it seem that it's just mean, you know, small and small. Mm. So that's important. It, you know, I reference the Houthis because that's how people in the West remember it, but we should make a habit of using the name that they actually prefer as a, you know, group or in any sense. But what I wanted to ask was in regard to the facilitation of that, based on your research, to what degree would you argue the Al Qaeda showing up in Yemen was facilitated, helped along by these Western forces, which your point was essentially saying, but you know, were they just flown over on jets in your opinion, like we've seen before, or, you know, how in your research, how have you seen that?
No, I mean, they were basically, yes, they were brought in from other areas. We know that they've come in from Syria, even in since around 2016 onwards. We know that radicalized fighters have been coming from Syria to Yemen, for example. But of course, there were also radicalized elements particularly in the south. In that region, of course, you need to understand the importance for Saudi Arabia. And by default, when I'm talking about Saudi Arabia, of course, I'm talking also about the US mm-hmm. and the UK. We have to remember that Aden in the south on the coast was a British colony until 1967. So, you know, from an imperialist or from a neo-imperialist perspective, of course, Britain is heavily involved in Yemen and is desperately trying to regain a foothold there. One person that I highly recommend to everyone to read if they really want to understand the history of Yemen is Dr. Issa Bloomi, B-L-U-M-I. He wrote, and I've forgotten the title of his book now, he'll kill me. But if you just look him up, he's written an excellent book on the history of Yemen. He actually lived in Yemen for some time. He's someone that really understands the history and the people themselves. And he's someone definitely worth following and worth reading. But the idea, and I think this was a 2008 WikiLeaks cable, which demonstrated that in reality, because the thing is that Saudi Arabia, for its oil transportation, it has an east-west line, but it doesn't have a line down to the southern coast. So in other words, the Bab al-Mandeb Straits to the west are under the control of the Yemenis. The Strait of Hormuz on the east is under the control of Iran. So Saudi is to a huge degree landlocked, mm-hmm. right, as regards exporting its oil and gas. But in the Marib region, and we'll talk about that following my conversation with the ambassador, but in Marib, which is to the northeast of Sana'a, the capital, you have, that's basically the oil-rich region of Yemen. But it's not only Yemeni resources. What this represents, what the control of the south represents, is a land route for Saudi Arabia to bring its own resources down to the southern coast and for them to be collected, if you like, without having to pass by Bab al-Mandeb or by the Straits mm-hmm. of Hormuz.
Yeah, and I argue that Egypt's regime change had a huge part of that as well with the Suez Canal. And then what really makes my skin crawl with this discussion is when we really take a step back and recognize what we're saying, they're willing to destroy, starve an entire nation just to be able to circumvent someone's control over a strait. That is the kind of people we're dealing with. I just want to make sure we recognize how disgusting that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what is going on in Yemen? I mean, I don't use the word genocide lightly, but it is a genocide. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the areas that are being targeted, I did actually a UN intervention with a Yemeni team of lawyers and specialists in 2016. And at that point, we were looking at the use of cluster bombs, which, of course, are illegal against civilian targets. And the huge stockpile that the Saudis had, produced by the US, of course, at that point, I can't remember who the major producer was of the cluster bombs, but they claimed that they had stopped production. But of course, that didn't mean that the Saudis didn't have a massive stockpile that they'd sort of set up previously.
Well, in regard to those cluster bombs, so I understand, like, for instance, like white phosphorus has this absurd loophole where they pretend that they're signaling, right? So it gets used all the time and they act like, oh, no, sorry, it melted those civilian skin. We were just signaling. You know, it's ridiculous. And it gets used by the Israelis constantly. But in regard to cluster bombs, if I understand it, they're just illegal, right? Like, you can't even stockpile them for some other purpose. Is that correct?
I'm trying to remember all the legislation that I looked into back then. My memory hole is not working.
I'll look that up.
I'll send you over actually the article that I did at the time. Okay. But basically, they're legal against military targets, so against tanks or armored vehicles, etc. Right.
We often find these loopholes like this where it's just, you know, and then, of course, we were aiming for that tank, but then we hit the school bus full of children, you know, this gets allowed by, you know, the good guy team.
It's also, I think there is legislation based on the failure rate. So the failure rate is that the pod, which contains the explosive clusters, doesn't explode. So then what happens is kids will come and pick it up and play with it because they look like toys, basically. And then, of course, the thing explodes in their hands. And this is where the mutilation comes in, because quite often, I think the acceptable failure rate is something like 99%, so 1% failure. But, you know, how they possibly analyze that in a war situation, in the use of old stock of cluster bombs, which is clearly what was going on with Saudi Arabia also. But the areas that were being deliberately targeted, of course, way more than any other area inside Yemen, were areas in the north that were traditionally Ansarullah strongholds. So Sada in the north on the border with Saudi Arabia was the most heavily targeted with cluster bombs. In fact, the whole area is decimated to the point where even humanitarian aid trucks from inside Yemen are targeted when they try to enter Sada. You know,
that is a part that I don't understand. I do understand it because it's very clear that this is something that's been sort of, you know, the UN in itself, in and of itself today, is seemingly facilitating this process, but that they can target these things. And that's happened more than once. And the UN stands up and says, we call for both sides to stand down, or, you know, whatever meaningless statement they keep making. And I don't wonder why people can't recognize how that goes at one after another, mm-hmm. or everyone should stand down. And the Houthis are the ones standing down and the Saudis attack and they blame the Houthis. It's happened 15 times since I've been covering this story.
Yeah. And especially in the port of Hodeidah, which was right. One of the long siege warfare narratives. And of course, there are huge similarities. Actually, again, this was part of the discussion with the ambassador. There are huge similarities between the narratives in Syria, you know, regarding the Syrian Arab Army operations to liberate areas from Al-Qaeda led and dominated sieges and occupations, etc., right? And that's exactly what's happening in Marib right now, according to the ambassador's side of the story. Hmm. Of course, I mean, it's difficult for me because unlike in Syria, I haven't been able to go to Yemen. I have tried on a number of occasions, but of course, the Saudis have shut down Sana'a Airport. It's almost impossible to get there, and it's very difficult to safely enter Yemen. We tried on a number of occasions. But just coming back to your point also about the UN's, you know, absolute collaboration with this genocide. And of course, this isn't the first time that's happened. If people are kind of listening and are a bit shocked, let's remember that the UN facilitated the sanctions against the Iraqis also, which led to the deaths of 500,000 children. Yeah. And Professor Francis Boyle, who's a human rights law professor, basically was involved in the case against the UN, etc., about, you know, about the fact that this was a genocide. And he openly, when he discussed Yemen with me, he said, it's exactly the same case. This is a UN-facilitated genocide.
Right.
Without a doubt. You know, and if you go back to 2016, if you remember, it was Ban Ki-moon who dared to put Saudi Arabia on the blacklist for their aggression against children in Yemen. And then almost immediately, the Sauds pulled out a fatwa, basically. A fatwa is a Sharia court ruling that they would withdraw funding from the UN. And suddenly, miraculously, they got removed from the blacklist. Right.
Which shows you it has nothing to do with anything other than money. I mean, it has nothing to do with whether they're actually committing crimes.
It's money, you know, and I remember at the same time that I was in the UN and we actually attended a Saudi meeting. And let's remember in July of 2016, USAID, CIA outreach agent, cut off the humanitarian funding tap to Yemen on the basis that the conflict was just too dangerous for them to be involved there. Almost immediately after, the King Salman Center was established, the humanitarian NGO established by the very person that was leading the aggression against the Yemenis to take over from USAID. So this, again, was clear collaboration between USAID and the Sauds to hand the control of humanitarian aid to the Sauds that were creating the situation which humanitarian aid was needed. I mean, this is, you know, the craziness of it.
One of the first articles that made me reach out to Whitney for the first time, and I believe this might have been her first video interview, like a long time ago, and I reached out right from Mint Press, and I just said, hey, this is amazing work. And we talked about her where Mohammed bin Salman stated that, you know, that what was it, that we will continue to kill children because we want them to shiver when they hear the name Saudi Arabia, right? This is what he stated. And we can have a quote like that from the leader and we can still act like he's over there. What was the term they're using? You know, they're changing, they're evolving, or what, I forget the term they use, but, and this is so incredible that they can state that and we just ignore it, you know? But this can bring us into where we are with this discussion, with what you heard from the ambassador. And, you know, so what did he tell you? What's going on there now after, you know, is it all changing? Is it all getting better? We hope. Probably not.
Well, I mean, you know, I think what I find just extraordinary about Yemen, it's had very little outside help. Contrary to the narratives that, you know, the Houthis are an Iranian proxy, this is, it can't actually be further from the truth. I remember when this war started and I was talking to, Yemenis, and I was trying to understand the fabric of society there, very similar to here in Syria. In the sense that the Shafi and the Zaydi, so the Sunni and the Shia communities, lived very much side by side. Mm-hmm. They would share mosques. I hear this time and time again, and I hear the same thing here. Nobody even knew if their neighbor was Zaydi or Shafi. Nobody really cared. You know, this kind of sectarian narrative was not really part of Yemeni culture at this time, according to those that I was talking to when the aggression started.
I just want to make sure so you're saying that that's how Syria was as well prior to U.S. invasion? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love to actually, we should do another interview just about that topic, because that's the whole targeting of, you know, Christians acting like, you know, there's a lot going on there. But please continue, because that's a huge point, that they created essentially what they claim they're trying to stop.
And so, I've kind of forgotten my.
Oh, my apologies. My apologies.
No, it's fine. That was me.
I just want to make sure I was understanding, because that was that's such an important thing that I've tried to circle around so many times. You know, that, or even going back to Iraq. You know, that where even his Ba'ath Party itself was a lot, they had a lot of Christians, or Syria having the third largest Christian population in all of the Middle East. And, you know, and it just, and then the U.S. government goes in fighting the extremist terrorism bad guys. And later it's 10 times worse than it was before. And now those Christians are gone. And now there's, you know, it's exactly what they claim they're trying to stop. And I just don't know why the people that buy their narrative can't just stand back and look at that. You know, even if they're trying to do the right thing, hold on, let's stop them from trying, because they're failing. They're batting zero pretty much, right? Every country they're liberating is now destroyed. So maybe we shouldn't let them do that anymore, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But I think, part of the discussion that I had, I'll come back to that until I pick up my other thread. Part of the discussion that I had with the ambassador was about the operations in Marib right now. As I said, Marib is effectively the center of oil and gas inside Yemen, to the northeast of Sana'a, the capital, which is under control of actually the Salvation Government, the coalition government. And, you know, this is another...
Apologies. No, sorry. That my window popped up. Go ahead. Please continue.
No, it's okay. So effectively, Yemen has a government. You know, this is the craziest thing. A government that has been constitutionally elected under Yemeni constitutional law. It represents, I believe, 38 political parties. So it is effectively a power share government. It's not, you know, an Ansarullah power grab, which of course is how it's always portrayed, particularly in pro-Israeli media, let's say. And Marib was effectively under control of forces of Mansour Hadi. Now, according to the ambassador, of course, what this means, it was under control of Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda elements. He actually said to me, the majority of the occupation forces are Al-Qaeda. And, you know, we come back to the fact that the Sauds themselves have admitted readily that they have been fighting alongside Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, for them, you know, it's a weapon, just as it is inside Syria. And so Mareb is, in the West, we have the narrative, of course, that Ansarullah is besieging. And this is where we get the similarity with the narratives in Syria. It was very interesting when I was talking to the ambassador a couple of days ago. And he said, look, effectively, yes, we have besieged this area, but we've provided humanitarian corridors for the few civilians that are left there to leave, which, you know, and you just smiled. I just smiled when he said it, because, of course, in the West, when the Syrian Arab Army was liberating an area, that's exactly what they would do. They would surround the area, which was occupied by Al-Qaeda elements and affiliates, and they would provide humanitarian corridors for those civilians trapped inside those areas to leave safely and to come to the humanitarian post set up by the Syrian Arab Army. So effectively, what the Yemeni ambassador told me, as I said, I'm not on the ground, I can't verify it, but this is what he told me. He said, we are trying to provide humanitarian corridors for those civilians that are left in these occupied areas to leave. Now, as he described it, Mareb is a turning point, because he said, if we capture Mareb, then to some degree, we're forcing them to come to the negotiating table. Mm-hmm. By them, he means the Saudi coalition. Because he said, this is the last enclave, really, of Hadi's power base. Mm-hmm. The south is another story. The south is more complex, because the south has the involvement of, as I said, Britain, particularly in Aden, trying to return to the secessionist days of having southern Yemen divorced from north Yemen. Mm-hmm. And under the control very much of the UAE and Israel, right? And providing them with that southern coastal pathway, right? But Mareb is something else. Mareb is something that Saudi Arabia, it's very much like Erdogan, Turkey, wanting Aleppo. Aleppo was the jewel in their policy against Syria. Mareb is the jewel for Saudi Arabia, right? So the fact that Ansarullah now is effectively advancing and basically taking Mareb, this, in their view, puts pressure on Saudi Arabia to have to come to the negotiating table. And what the ambassador said to me was, we can't negotiate until the UN revise the resolution 2216. As I said to you, 2216 was brought in at the beginning of the war. It targeted, in the beginning, five named individuals. And on the basis of those five named individuals, the entire blockade and siege and sanctions against 27 million Yemenis was brought in by Saudi Arabia. And reinforced by the UN, who brought in their verification mechanism, which meant that any humanitarian aid vessels coming into port are then being held back until effectively the food is perished, until, right. You know, so this is a UN mechanism which is actually deepening the blockade, actually reinforcing the blockade, not enabling it, not helping it.
Under right. The guise of actually doing it, and while the Saudis are targeting and bombing food infrastructure and grain yeah. mills, and you know, so obviously there's a coordination happening there. They must yeah. know that, because we were reporting that, and I've seen that reported for months and months and months. So the UN is aware that they're letting this food spoil. So it shows you that there's this illusion of a process that's, you know, there's people absolutely allowing this stuff to happen. Now, do you think that any of that would be happening? Like, for instance, with the Mareb point, Mareb, saying it incorrectly, the point in regard to them using that as sort of a piece to force them to the table. I don't think that the Saudis in any case are making a move in this regard without the U.S. and Israel's go ahead, in my opinion. So
no, exactly.
So with the U.S. and Israel pulling out their support, or whether they're giving the support, is the only factor, I think, on whether or not the Saudis will continue. So how do you see that going, to kind of pull off a little point right there in regard to Biden? Right. We know, I think Netanyahu's stance is quite clear. But with Biden mm-hmm. entering this, Robert Imlekesh has had a couple interesting points here. Do you see him progressing this, keeping it going? I mean, and that same point, did the Yemeni ambassador have any points in that regard?
No, I mean, I think they see it very much that the leverage they have. I mean, he told me that basically the Saudis who are enraged that Marib is being, you know, liberated from their grasp, have basically said or issued a warning or a threat that if Marib is fully taken, they will destroy the oil fields. Mm. So the Ansarullah response has been, okay, well, then we'll start targeting Armco. We'll start targeting your oil fields.
And they know that. You know, they've made that very clear.
Yeah, and they know that because, I mean, they've been doing it in the last couple of weeks. You know, they've, and so I think the thing is, historically, as soon as Saudi starts to get hurt, you see them start to put pressure on the US to pull back. And, you know, this is where the Yemenis, in my view, have an advantage to some degree over Syria, for example. You know, Syria, particularly in the military campaign, it is sometimes hampered by the political process that is being instigated by Russia, mm-hmm. right? You know, that's real politics. That's a fact. When we remember the liberation of East Aleppo, the number of ceasefires we had because Russia was calling for negotiations and blah, 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 right? So there was a degree of political pressure on the military campaign. Yemen doesn't have that pressure from any outside influence right now, right? It can basically carry out its military campaign according to the Yemeni army, the Yemeni military, the Ansarullah military, and the in-situ government. So it is relatively free to maintain a military campaign against Saudi Arabia, right? And it can target a Saudi Arabian oil field. So at the moment, there's a bit of a stalemate on that as far as I can see.
I've also noticed an interesting point there is that, remember the first time, at least, that it was very public when Ansarullah had attacked, or the one they tried to blame on Iran that was really publicized. They tried to make it out to be Iran attacking Saudi Arabia. And it was just, you know, they made it out to be like this breathless, we're all about to go to war kind of scenario, the same way they used to do it about North Korea when they chose to. And then suddenly things changed, narrative shifted, the other things started, and the Ansarullah has carried out more. I mean, what I think I could remember at least three or four different attacks where they hit targets and not a peep from the mainstream media. Saudi Arabia must know that, right? So they know that they've lost the favor of being the big danger, you know. So there, I think that plays a huge factor. And to your point, again, going back to that same idea, they, without the support, with the explicit support of the U.S. government and the U.S. military, I doubt Saudis would do anything of the kind. That's just my take on it. But I think they will continue to have the support of the U.S. regardless of what Biden will say politically. That's my take on it, though. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, and Biden's posturing politically is, for me, utterly meaningless because, you know, he's on one hand saying we're no longer going to support Saudi aggression, but we will defend Saudi Arabia against aggression. You know,
and we know defense is literally everything.
Yeah, it's just a you know, it's just a bit of smoke and mirrors from Biden, to be honest. And it's, in my view, it's utterly meaningless. I mean, these days, I don't actually believe one word that comes out of one American official's mouth. You know, it's just look for the opposite because they'll always be doing a deal and they'll always betray whatever statement they make, you know, the minute that it becomes more viable to turncoat on it, basically. Yeah.
History is very clear on that, by the way. History makes that obvious that that's what they continue to do.
But one thing that I did want to come back to, because just to come back to the UN, if I can, really quickly, and this is from the article that I wrote last year, and I'll send it over to you for the show notes. But at that point, I spoke to the spokesperson for the Yemeni Health Ministry, Dr. Yusuf Al-Hadri, and I asked him to talk about, at that point, I think it was Mark Lowcock, who is actually also the UN representative in Syria, who was talking about the humanitarian response plan from Saudi Arabia, the United States, United Arab Emirates, and the UK. So the four countries that are effectively raping and pillaging Yemen are the ones supposedly providing the humanitarian relief. I mean, this is, this is
the real world equivalent of, we investigated and found ourselves not guilty, right?
Exactly. You know, it's quite extraordinary. And, you know, what was really interesting is when you talk to Yemeni officials, is the depth of their understanding of the corruption within these organizations and the exploitation of these organizations to further the political agenda, the geopolitical agendas of the countries that are controlling this humanitarian relief, right? And, you know, he went on to say that basically the UN must provide political and media support for these nations because, as we said in 2016, Saudi Arabia was put on the blacklist. The minute that it threatened to withdraw funding, it was taken off the blacklist. You know, again, where do we see that? Also with Israel, of course. Mm-hmm. And then, so the UN also, this is an important point, it tried to transfer the Yemeni central bank from Sana'a to Aden. And of course, Aden is effectively under the control of the four nations, Saudi Arabia, UAE, which we know now is being power multiplied by Israel. Israel and UAE are forming a sort of coalition almost in competition with Saudi Arabia. And whatever actions you see the UAE taking in Yemen will be with the backing of Israel. That's quite an important point to make. And so the decision to do this was in 2016. And from that day until today, 80% of Yemeni people live without an annual government budget of $15 billion. So effectively what he was saying was, they stole $15 billion from us, and here they are giving us $2 billion in humanitarian aid. So, you know, I just wanted to get these points across for people to really understand the corruption, the corrosion of the UN as any kind of impartial body. It is not. It is the most politicized, weaponized organization in the world today, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I agree completely. We've seen examples like that from, you know, Israel in regard to Syria. We've seen examples just like that in regard to Venezuela, where they've robbed them of billions of dollars and given them hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. You know, it's so insulting to see that happen, for sure.
Exactly.
But I would also add, just one quick point in regard to the UN, that I always make sure we point this out, that the UN is definitely an organization that is not fighting for the interests of what they claim they are. But there are always the individuals, I argue, that may try, just like we would argue anywhere else. Like, I look at someone like the Evo Morales, who stood up and gave that major speech about the US and everything else. And at the time I said, oh, here, regime change coming his way. And sure enough, it did. But, you know, I see those as, at least not everybody who says something in a UN chair should be seen as, you know what I mean? Like, that's one of the things we tend to do in this community is, well, the UN's bad, so UN, nothing UN says is ever taken at face value. And that's, you know, but your point is absolutely correct. It is a toothless tiger today, in my opinion.
Yeah. And he went on also to tell me that 25 to 60% of these humanitarian relief funds disappear as an operating budget for the UN-sponsored organizations and agencies and their leaders in Yemen and abroad, right? He explained, for example, the health sector plan in Yemen for 2019 was duly submitted to the UN. To date, only 19% has actually been implemented. There is a deficit of 81%, right?
That's incredible.
These countries, as he says, they besiege and starve the Yemeni people, leaving us with thousands dead. Countless civilians with chronic illnesses that we cannot treat, including cancer, because of the blockade. They're not even allowed to leave the country for treatment. And then he goes on to say, so basically they're saying they're going to provide $2 billion, having already stolen $15 billion, et cetera, as I've just said. And then he said, but Saudi Arabia and UAE have spent more than $200 billion to purchase American and British bombs and weapon systems to murder the Yemeni people. Right. So, you know, this is, I mean, he put it so concisely, and so logically, you know, and he said, this is, we're disgusted. We don't want humanitarian aid. And that's what I hear here in Syria. Nobody wants humanitarian aid.
Right.
They just want the sanctions lifted, the blockade lifted. They want to be able to come to a peaceful resolution, which actually the Yemenis already had. I mean, again, I have to, you know, keep reiterating this because people don't understand this fact. Political resolution had been arrived at when the Saudis started bombing. I mean, this is, you know, and this was endorsed by Obama. So successive American administrations from Obama to Trump, now to Biden, have been focused on the devastation of Yemen in order to, as you said, further their geopolitical interests.
That is
and those of their allies.
Yes, and that is such an important point for Americans to think about. The whole two-party, I mean, talking about a group with 38 different parties under one flag, we're over here screaming at each other about two parties that are really the same thing, and that's exactly the point. We can see the administrations, the major goals of the unelected power structure are always continued, and that's what we continue to see, and we see acting like there's different things, different objectives. You know, Obama to Trump to Biden, they're going to continue the same thing, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Bolivia, whether it's Yemen. And those are all very clear. And there's what you just stated, the fact that this is not just a U.S. agenda, though. That's what's really alarming, is that all of these Western countries are at least complicit, taking a part in what's happening and, you know, stealing and profiting in places that they can. And we saw the same thing with Libya. I mean, what I was blown away about, just on a side note about that, is we can see now Eric Prince, it's been revealed that he was in there trying to, you know, overthrow the UN-backed government more than once during that whole thing. And that's, so it turns out again that we have outside parties trying to take what they want from a place that they just left to the side for a decade after they destroyed it, acting like they liberated it. And it just really makes you sick to see that this is human life being used to emotionally manipulate the people who think they care about it in order to use that empathy and that emotion to go in there and hurt those same people and rob what they need to survive. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and I really wanted to make the strong point. You know, I see a lot of people quite rightly sharing information from UNICEF, from the UN, from all these agencies. You know, a humanitarian disaster of biblical proportions in Yemen. Look, this is not some kind of, it's not something that is happening to the Yemeni people. It's something that is being done to the Yemeni people.
Exactly.
Okay? And it's being done by those very agencies that are selling this humanitarian disaster to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that you want to share that. I really understand that. But we need to start thinking beyond this kind of, yeah, I have a stakeholding in human misery because I'm sharing a UNICEF post. And I'm sorry, I'm not belittling people's humanitarian reflex here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying we need to get out of this NGO complex response. You know, we need to start thinking more like human beings, in empathy with the human beings in Yemen, and understanding who is enforcing this starvation upon them. Who is ensuring that kids with cancer can't get treatment? Who's ensuring that all the hospitals are destroyed, that they have no clean water, that, you know, they have nothing, literally nothing. They are completely blockaded. And the UN is enabling this to happen. So please, when you share something that talks about the Yemeni starvation, please point the finger at those agencies for what they're doing, for what they're allowing, for what they're not preventing.
Absolutely. You know, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And I often try to share these, what I, in my show especially, to sort of make the point from within their narrative, right? So here is a group, as we point out, is responsible. Mm. Here they are pointing out that this is terrible, right? And it's just that, and as you're pointing out, is ridiculous. But the NGO part is so interesting because it almost seems like this is the whole public-private partnership thing, right, in regard to foreign policy, right? It's just obviously not non-governmental organizations. They're very clearly associated with the government. And like James Corbett puts it, the Trojan horses of today, you know, the CIA Trojan horses.
You know, and they're heavily politicized. These are not impartial, neutral organizations. exactly yeah. like the white helmets in Syria. You know, you can't claim to be impartial and neutral when you're funded by governments that have a vested interest in an outcome in one particular nation. You can't. Yeah. It's impossible.
Well, yeah, you can't be impartial when you're literally taking a side either, which is just really stupid.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and as they regularly do, Human Rights Watch. I mean, the thing is, a lot of these organizations have a revolving door with deep state in the US in particular, but also with British intelligence agencies. And that brings us really nicely on to maybe the last thing that we should discuss, which is the recent revelations of intelligence operations to destabilize Yemen. First of all, was the capture of three British agents inside the eastern provinces of in the Al Mara province in Yemen. Now, it came out that under interrogation, of course, you know, we don't know how they were interrogated, etc., but they were filmed. These were Yemeni nationals that had been recruited by the CIA and MI6 and trained to basically feed coordinates back to the British and American agents of Ansarullah and Yemeni army positions and drone bases, air defense bases, etc., to enable the Saudi coalition, presumably, to target those bases. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we see very clearly, just as we've seen in Syria, not only a kind of mission creep from American troops and British troops in the south, but now also intelligence operations on Yemeni soil, recruiting Yemeni nationals to turn against their own, national army, their own resistance, and to basically identify their meager defense capability in order to have it destroyed by the Saudi coalition. So, you know, this is clear and direct interference.
Yes.
State affairs by British and American intelligence. Of course, we're not surprised, but, right. you know, this is just clear, absolutely clear. And then today, I think you mentioned the fact that they've released recordings of the former CIA head asking Ali Abdullah Saleh to release, actually an Al-Qaeda leader, not just a member, an Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. leader. So right. we come back to the fact that the CIA in the US deep state were effectively enabling and allowing Al-Qaeda to grow when it served their purposes in Yemen, as they have done, of course, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Africa.
Yeah. Well, so when were the three you discussed? When did that take place? When were they captured, and when did this happen?
That was a couple of weeks ago. So not long, actually, before. But the thing is that now they've managed to get their hands on a number of American intelligence documents.
Mm, interesting.
So there will be probably more revelations coming to the surface in the next few weeks, I would guess.
It's just incredible to see this coming from the very people that have been incessantly screaming about meddling and you know, all the different stuff we keep hearing. And this
Russia,
is
Russia.
right. I mean, this is not new for people like us or anybody even barely looking into this, because the CIA and these governments collectively have been doing this kind of thing openly. It's an open secret for a really long time. And of course, it's for freedom, though, so it doesn't really matter when they get pressed about it. You know, these are overt crimes and overt meddling and manipulating in a sovereign country's affairs because they think they're doing the right thing, they tell us that they think they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. But so bringing it to this one, because this is specific, right? So this is really important, because this is on record, and maybe I can just play it as we go out. So it's a 7-minute clip, but I'll play a little piece of it that he's on record on the phone stating that they are asking for this Al-Qaeda member to be released. Now, so are you familiar with this tape?
I haven't heard it, actually. I've only seen the actual report. I haven't listened to it.
This is kind of new to breaking as well for me. And what I was curious whether or not they get into the exchange about for what and what was it that they, you know, what was we asking for? But the simple point is that the CIA is asking for a leader of Al-Qaeda. Now, why would that be the case? Right. I mean, this is not what's interesting is he actually states it as like a personal favor. Like this is somebody that's, what do you say? Like this is important to me personally.
Well, and also, I think what's also important to point out here and make the connection, of course, is that under Biden, the pressure is being put on President Assad yet again to meet with the American demands in order for sanctions to be lifted. And one of those demands is the release of prisoners. And as prisoners, of course, we can ascertain that those will be the Islamist radicals that have been arrested through the war. So in other words, Al-Qaeda. So, you know, you have a parallel again in the sense that part of the conditions of lifting the sanctions against Syria is the release of what they will call political prisoners, what we will call here or what the Syrian government will call Islamist extremists,
or what they actually are, right? And this is remember this, people listening, when we get to September 11th again, that's the same thing they do every year and rattle off about how we were defended and Al-Qaeda attacked us while they're working with Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria and Yemen and everywhere else. That this is the thing that really needs to break through to some people, is whether it's Biden or Trump, your government is involved in all of this stuff. And they're openly, happily, I doubt there's any qualms about even doing these things. I mean, we continue to see it go forward in every case of war that they're involved in. This is who they are. I don't know how we can see it any other way. But bringing this to the rest of the conversation you had with the ambassador in general, were there any other important things that were discussed that you felt relevant for any Americans or anyone else there? Likewise, seeing how I'm an American in the United States, but this is obviously relevant to pretty much anybody out there, or rather just, you know, any thoughts really to wrap this up today about what you think about where Yemen is going and you know, it's because it's really disconcerting for someone like me to be having been following this long after it had started and seeing how very apparent it is that this is happening, that it's a criminal activity, that they're doing this in breaking the law openly, and yet it just continues to march forward. Mm. The world's worst humanitarian crisis, and it just continues. I mean, I just don't understand how that can even be possible in a country or countries that pretend that they want good things and fighting for human rights. I mean, it's crazy.
Mm. I think, you know, I was thinking about it before I came on, and I think the most important point that the ambassador made is that nothing can progress constructively for Yemen until the UN resolution 2216 is replaced. And so I think if there is any possibility of people, I don't know, forming petitions, you know, and sending to the UN, forming some kind of campaign to highlight the criminality of resolution 2216 that is effectively being used as a genocidal weapon against the Yemeni people. I can't put it any more clearly than that. Mm-hmm. It's a resolution which is based in illegitimacy, and it is being exploited by the Saudi coalition to kill Yemeni people on a massive scale through starvation, through blockade, through siege, through bombing, right?
Yeah.
And it's being enabled and facilitated by the UN. And I think, you know, this has to be one of the crimes of the century. And so this is what people should be writing to their congressman about. I mean, Rand Paul, I don't know if Rand Paul has actually kind of covered it to that degree, but he's done some very good work on Yemen. So, you know, I think this is something, me personally, this is what I would like people to focus on, to do what they can to raise awareness about that and to put pressure on the Biden administration, if they can in any way, that this resolution has to be reviewed and it has to be changed to take into account the political landscape in Yemen as it is now, you know. Mm-hmm. And Russia and Iran also have, you know, they, for me, they've also been negligent because, okay, maybe we shouldn't expect them to militarily expand themselves into Yemen, but they could have diplomatically supported the Yemeni transitional government, which they haven't done.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important here. You know, if we really believe in democracy, then Yemen has demonstrated democracy. And exactly. So therefore it should be supported and that should be highlighted.
Right. Except that that's not the case, right? We can see that in Bolivia. We can see where they pretend
exactly.
Venezuela, but they really don't, right? They care about acting like they care about democracy to make you think they do.
Yeah.
So they can use that to coerce people to do what they want. And guys, to end here, I just want you to recognize what we're looking at, whether it's the CIA asking for Al-Qaeda leaders so they can use them elsewhere, or the ongoing open genocide being committed by these governments in Yemen. This is what terrorism looks like. I don't care what, it doesn't matter whether you're doing it for a good reason or fighting for freedom or doing it because you think it's a means to an end. This is what terrorism looks like. And we need to recognize that so we can actually, to stop terrorism is a dumb thing to say anyway. It's always, people will commit acts, but we need to recognize it, point it out, and not, wage a meaningless, nebulous war against something that will never end unless we recognize where it's actually coming from. So thank you so much for being here today, Vanessa, and always keeping us up to date on what's actually going on. So for those, stay tuned. I'm going to play this on the way out so you guys can hear what this was actually, the discussion of the CIA officer with Yemen and how they're asking for him to release the CIA member. But anything else you want to leave us with here, Vanessa, before I let you go?
No, I think it's important to end on that resolution. 2216, and to ask people to do what they can to support Yemen by getting that reviewed.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, as always, everybody, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Rather unsuccessful. Do you have his name?
I don't want to use names on the phone. They know who his name is.
أنا لا أتكلم بالأسماء. أنا لا أحب ذكر الأسماء من خلال التلفونات ولكن الأمن السياسي عندكم يعلم جيدا من هو الشخص ولقد تحدث رئيس المحققين مع الأمن السياسي عندكم ولكن دون جدوى ودون نجاح
أصحاب التحقيقات المكتب الفيدرالي موجودين تقريبا في صنعاء خليهم يفوتوا علي بكرة ومع السفيرة والدولة الإس وهذه الحالة وسنبحث هذا الموضوع بجدية.
Sir George, I believe the FBI people have already arrived in Sana'a. They are now in Yemen. Why don't you recommend them to come and meet me tomorrow along with the US ambassador and present this case during my discussion with them and we can discuss about it.
President, I'm happy to that, but let me say something very important.
أنا سأقوم بذلك ولكن دعني أقول شيئاً آخر.
I'm happy to have this, but I don't need anybody else. This is my person. This is my problem. This is my issue. And I'm calling you because it's very serious with me personally. This man must be released. Major General Al-Kamish, is that his name? The PSO director, Major General Ghalib Al-Kamish. He knows all about this.
Mohammed al-Rais.
Ambassador, and quite frankly, I'm calling because it's my responsibility. I've talked to everybody in my government. I told them that I was going to make this call. I want to work with you, but I need this man released in the next 48 hours. This is my very personal.